Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Daryl Urbanski, your host as always. And today we are joined by Vic Dorson. Vic is a manufacturing business coach, business advisor, and principal of the Collaborative Group. For decades, Vic has helped private manufacturing companies turn hard work into stronger profits, better systems, and business value. He works with owners and leadership teams to sharpen strategy, improve operations, build accountability, and prepare companies for growth or a successful exit. Vic does not replace what a business already does well. He strengthens how the business is run. With experience across manufacturing, packaging, technology, mergers, acquisitions, and executive leadership, Vic helps good companies become more focused, more valuable, and more ready for the future. I've asked him to join us here today to share his story and insights into timeless strategies to navigate the future of business. So Vic, thanks so much for joining us, my friend. How are you?
I'm very well, and it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Daryl.
Yeah, well, it's an honor and a pleasure to have you. We've had a couple of chats prior to this. I always enjoy spending time chatting with you. There's so much to learn, so much to share. How did you even get started, though? Like, do you come from a family of entrepreneurs? Has this been sort of your, like, are you just carrying the torch of your grandparents and your parents?
No, my parents were immigrants to Australia, and they left Europe before the Second World War started and came to Australia. And my father was an academic. He was a lawyer. And my mother was a saleswoman in a high fashion store in Vienna. And they came to Australia separately, but got married, and our family grew up here. So my father couldn't practice law, and he became a businessman, but he was an unhappy businessman. You know, if he could have studied law, if he would have had the money when he arrived here, he would have done that. So, but he died very young. He was 51, and so my career started at that time. My mother and I. We didn't realize how poor we were till my father died, and my mother and I had to start working to put food on the table. And there were four of us in the family. There was my mother and my grandmother and my brother and I. And I got a job as a production planner, and I didn't even know what a production planner was, but the company was hiring, and it was a packaging company, and that's how my career started. I became a packaging engineer, and then I had to study at night because I was working during the day, and I got various other degrees in marketing and manufacturing and my packaging degree, and that enabled me to, you know, to start and continue.
So you said you studied at night to learn more about marketing and manufacturing. So what was the next step? You were a packaging engineer, and how did you use the marketing and manufacturing education that you got? Where did that take you?
Well, the manufacturing, you know, if you design a package to run down a line and to understand the processes of manufacturing and the theory of it, it helps. And I felt that I should understand something about marketing because it was at that time very much the buzzword, as it still is today. And so, yeah, so I did those two degrees, you know, Bachelor of Business Marketing and Bachelor of Business Manufacturing, and plus my packaging engineering. And as soon as I graduated, I went overseas. I had a year in the States as a packaging engineer with Lever Brothers. And then I went to the UK, and I fell on my feet there. America wasn't my country. And so I'm talking culturally. Very nice people, but
sure.
But I went to England, I fell on my feet, and I got a job at a company called Roussel Laboratories, who no longer exist. They were taken over by Roche, I think. And I fell on, I did very well there. I was head of packaging development. I had a group of people underneath me, and we did well. And then by a fluke, I met an entrepreneur in London at a lunch. And I was asked to tell him what I did. And 10 minutes later, he said, "Why don't you do what you do as a consultant, and I'll finance you?" And I rang one of my colleagues who was around my age, but his strength was in production. And we started a packaging consultancy called Adept. And over the next 12 years, we became the biggest packaging consultancy in Europe.
That's huge.
So,
congratulations.
And then I got married. I was in my mid-30s. I got married. I had a son. and I wanted him to grow up and go surfing and play cricket. So I came back to Australia. And now my son lives in Greece, which is, but at least I got my daughter here. And nobody wanted to pay for the packaging development as they did in Europe.
Right.
So I went into corporate life, and I was general manager at a company called Hunter Douglas, and then with a Japanese electronics firm called Toshiba. And then I joined, at that time, they no longer exist, a company called Acelti. They were the world's biggest stationery company, and I was vice president for the Asia Pacific area. Anyway, I left there and became a consultant, and I've been doing that. I've just started my 19th year as a consultant.
Wow, so you're new to it. You're just figuring out what you're doing after 19 plus.
Six months ago, I finally understood what was happening.
I love that. So, I mean, that's such a well-decorated and accomplished career. What were some of the biggest challenges that you faced, and how did you overcome it? Because I mean, you're still just in your prime now, but you've obviously seen a lot of upturns, downturns, and different cultures. That's something that I think is underappreciated, understanding the different markets, the different cultures, how what works, like you mentioned. There's almost an energy to places, too, that's unique to every person, every place. So United States, like you said, a lot of opportunity there, a lot of great people, but it just didn't jive. And then when you hit the UK, that was it for you. So, you know, what have been some of the biggest challenges, and how would you overcome them? Or how did
that's
you?
That's a very clever question. When I arrived in the US, you know, I thought it'd be, I didn't even think about it, but I just imagined that it would be exactly the same as Australia. You know,
right.
But I found very, very quickly that it was culturally different.
Yeah.
And that even the way we use words and our understanding of them was different. And to try and be an Australian in America was a real mistake. I had to be Australian who lived there and pick up the values and the culture of the country. And that proved true when we grew with Adept. We started off in the UK and then got more and more business in Europe. It was true whether we were doing business in Germany or Holland or Spain or France, you know, you had to click in with the culture. Mm-hmm. And when you were, you know, if we did a redesign and cost-saving exercise on a manufacturing operation, you know, you had to click in with the way that people thought and the way they looked at things there to influence them to change and to begin with you. Yeah. So to fight that culture. And it's quite interesting that in my time at Acelti, one of the joint ventures we did was in China. And for a year, I traveled through China looking at different companies to be our joint venture partner. And it was quite difficult. Yeah, and we've got an organization in Australia called Austrade, who paved the way for Australia's trading arrangements with other countries. And you know, it's interesting how I've just explained in the US and in Europe how I learned the lesson of clicking in culturally.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't getting anywhere, and the head of Austrade took me aside and told me off. And he said, "Vic, you know, stop trying to apply your Western business philosophy here.
Yep.
Click in with what's happening." And he was right. And I changed immediately because I'd experienced before, and we took off. And then we created a joint venture, build a factory
What would you recommend to someone? Because this is such an important and it's an underappreciated thing. And obviously it only relates to someone trying to do business internationally in other places, but it is so real. I went and worked in Japan for 3 years. And I remember when my friend dropped me off at the airport, I spent the summer visiting and taking time off in British Columbia. And I remember he was like, sayonara. He said something like sayonara. And I remember walking the airplane. I was like, all right, that's Japanese, right? Like, I was so clueless. People said, what about the culture shock? And I said, culture schmulture. We all have moms and hair and hearts and skin. And it took me maybe a year and a half until I realized just how, by being my friendly Canadian self, how offensive I was being on a day-to-day basis without realizing it, because my culture was different. As a simple example, in most Western cultures, you sort of have three layers of etiquette. You have rude, casual, and polite. But in Japan, they have five layers of etiquette. I had a friend who lived there for 16 years, and after being there 12, 13 years, got married. And I asked him, what was that like? He said, it was the strangest experience because I'd been here for over 10 years. I speak Japanese pretty well. And I woke up on my wedding day and I couldn't understand what people were saying. And I was being ushered through this event in these days. People are like talking and crying, and I have no real idea what they're saying. And it's because they were speaking to him at the highest level of etiquette, and he'd never heard it before. And it was so foreign to him. And so it's just a real, now like I'm in the Philippines, and it's a very similar thing here. I've been here, you know, 8 years. So what would you recommend to someone who's starting out and struggling? Like they're in a culture or they're thinking of going somewhere and they're approaching this click-in concept. What would you recommend?
Well, if it's the first time, because, you know, when I was the vice president of Asia Pacific, I looked after Japan, and I know exactly what you're talking about. And when I went to India, you know, it's, again, you know, it's not like, at least if you go to London or France or something, it's a lot easier to click in. But when the cultural is so ingrained in people and so different, I think you've just got to take the time. You've got to, instead of going in and I know this, you've got to take the time to understand them and see what their values are and what their cultural expectation is. Because as you said, especially in Japan, you can insult someone very easily because, you know, you don't understand the protocol of doing it.
I remember I went to go to this international grocer once. I was looking for mango chutney, just as an example for people. I was looking for mango chutney and I bought it there a couple of times and there was none on the shelf. And I go to the lady behind the counter and I go, mango chutney, arimasuka, do you have mango chutney? And she replied, said, ima wa chotto, right now is a little. And I was like, now's a little what? Like, come back next week. You're going to look in the back. I didn't understand. And she started like getting nervous and sweating. I'm like, what is going on here? Like, do you have, like, what is it in the, what's going on? And I remember at one point she looked around the store to see if anyone was there. And she looked at me and she went, nai. And she covered her face because she was so like, it's so direct to say, no, we don't have any. Because when she said right now is a little, that was my opportunity to interject and be like, you know what? Actually, I've got to go do this other thing and I'll look there. They believe in social cohesion to the point.
Yeah.
I brought some people with me to Japan for like this martial arts tourism thing. And one of them went with me to my Japanese grandma outside Kyoto. And I remember we were gone for the day. We came back and we had food. And I remember this moment where I was eating and I was done. But Matt was ravenously hungry. And I remember he was eating his food. And the girl, my Japanese sister, Yasuko, and her grandma brought him another bowl of food. And there was like three different sides. They brought the side he liked and ate the most of and another bowl of food. He didn't have to ask. And I recognized what had just happened, that they were watching him eat and anticipating his needs, that's the culture. So they believe in social harmony to the point where you anticipate someone's needs. And you don't have to be so direct to be like, no, we don't have it. Like, that was so rude and offensive, what happened in that chutney store, that I forced her to lose face by admitting she could not fulfill my needs at that time. Like, it's for Western. Yeah. Like, what's the big deal? Like, I don't get it, you know, but just as a...
It's interesting. I went with our managing director at Toshiba. And as I said, I was the general manager and we had to do a presentation to the head office and some of the most senior managers. And we booked into the hotel, just went there. They put us in different rooms on different floors. And anyway, when the day finished, we all went to dinner at this hotel. And when we finished late at night, you know, a lot of sake and wine were drunk. And one of the most senior managers said to me, which hotel are you staying at? I said, oh, this one. And he said to me, I'm staying here too. He said, what floor are you on? And it turned out I was on a floor higher than anyone else. And the next morning, the managing director, who was an Australian, came to me and said, Vic, you've got to move your room to a lower floor because you're junior. And you can't say anything. You just got to do it.
Yeah.
So that was an interesting thing. But I think and in a way, you never stop learning. I guess that's and clicking in with the behaviors. And in business, you know, it comes to the fore. It's not just in the social aspects, but it's in the business. And you know, when at that time in France is a different country now to what it was then. But when you're in France, for example, I just clicked in and behaved, you know, just as aggressively to them as they behave to me, you know, and because they treat each other like that. So
yeah.
You know, anyway, but it's a good lesson to know when and how to behave. And I think in business, it does you well to do that.
So that's about kind of dealing with the people. Now, my next question is about structuring a business or even operating a business. Like often they say, begin with the end in mind. If you were to structure a business to sell, or again, just, you know, there's the human component, but then there's sort of the operations, technicality, structure of it. Does that vary a lot by country, or is it their standard? Is it sort of a standard assembly line, so to speak, that marketing leads to this, leads to that, leads to?
So my experience is this, and it's been reinforced a set of, I've just started my 19th year as a consultant. And one of the things that I learned in my career and is that you've got to be able to clearly define and articulate your objectives to the people within the company, the people you work with, your colleagues and your staff. And if I tell you that over the last 18 years, I ask every prospective client, tell me, okay?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good.
Everything. Tell me what your objectives are. 95 cannot articulate them. And so that's the first thing you've got, because a lot of people are very good at what they do. They go to work every day. They work hard. They go home tired. And it's a repetition of what they've done the day before. And if you say, for example, I had a client, $20 million turnover, family business, a mother and father and three sons, and they were doing a little better than break even. They weren't taking home very much money, $20 million, and they had a fraction, they had about 0.5% of the market, and yet they hadn't grown in 3 years. They weren't doing particularly well. And so, you know, they didn't have objectives. And once we defined what those objectives were, growth, profitability, and so forth, you know, you can then develop a strategy to achieve those objectives. But if you don't have those objectives, you can't have a strategy. Yeah. And that was in my own career. And when I've been in consulting, it's the same issue. That's the first thing you've got to establish. What are my objectives? They've got to be realistic. They've got to be achievable. You know, so often you say, I'm going to do 100. And this happens to me a lot in corporate life. And the message would come back, look, Vic, thanks very much, but we think you should do 120.
Yeah.
You say, no, if we do 100, we've made real progress. And so everyone has got to understand it's got to be realistic so you can achieve it. Yeah. And I still mean extend, be the best you can, but you've got to be able to achieve it. If you give people goals that are unachievable, it hurts the morale of the business. It hurts the morale of the individual, and they lose that commitment to the business.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I really, it reminded me of a Jim Rohn quote. Jim Rohn's like the godfather of personal development. And he used to say, if you have someone, if you have an idiot and you motivate him, now all you have is a motivated idiot. What they need is an education to point them in the right direction. And then at least they'll get there, whether it's right now or in the future. And that's sort of what you're talking about, that if the company is just sort of showing up every day, and sometimes just happens because you get sort of like hypnosis, almost like highway hypnosis. You're just going down a road and you just lose track, get lost in the day-to-day movement, that you need to kind of have a North Star for everyone to understand and understand how their role fits into that. And something that I think is really important, how I handle that. I mean, people may have heard of SMART goals, specific, measurable, ambitious, right, but realistic and time-bound, that if you create goals that match that, one of the things that I like to help make them realistic is to then take this SMART goal and break it down into three sub goals that are process driven. So it's, you know, for example, if my SMART goal was to do 100 pushups in 30 days, then the three key metrics might be like, I do pushups every day. Like, you know, and that's a measurable thing. That's a sub, that's a process that if I do practice every day, that if I perform well at that, it should lead to that. And I come up with three of those that are complementary. So you then have your SMART goal, but you break it into three sub goals that are processed, like day-to-day measurements, that ultimately, if you do well, would lead to that. And I think, like, it seems so simple, but often the devil's in the details, right? I think, like you said, company doing 20 million a year, meanwhile, they're not taking home profit and they've got market share, but they're not growing. Like, these are the most basic things that the early stage startups are focused on, you know, like, but this big company lost sight of that.
And just to reinforce that, that's absolutely correct what you're saying. Once you've got your objectives and you've got your strategy, then you can define what the different, let's say the people on the management team have to achieve. and you agree that with them because they understand the strategy and you hold them accountable to that. Yeah. And that's a seesaw. It's moving all the time and you've got to bring it back to equilibrium. Yeah. In the day-to-day valuation of what has to be done. And the interesting thing is that, let's say you're in the management team and you agree it and you know, if you're the managing director or the CEO, and you make sure that you work with your team, that they understand it. And, you know, as I said, you cope with the day-to-day variations, and then they go and interpret that to their subordinates. And then the next line and the next line. And by the time it gets down to two or three lines, it's already lost something. So the senior manager's got to understand that at every level, people have got to understand what the objectives of the business are, what they're trying to achieve and why, and what their role in is it. And you've got to train and develop people. Yeah. And that's ongoing. It never stops. What the definition of, because that's professionalism, and the definition of that to my mind is I'll do better today that which I did yesterday.
Yeah.
And business is not a game. You know, you've got the sporting analogy, and business is not a game, it's a sport. And if you look at the great tennis players or the football players, every time you hear them interviewed, we can improve. And that's the same in business, you know?
Yep.
As I said, I'll do better today that which I did yesterday. And that should be the red line that runs through everything.
I love that. Yeah, there's a quote, good, better, best, never let it rest until your good becomes
yeah,
better.
That's right.
Your better is your best. No, I love that. I mean, that's what we're here for. Here for growth. When you plant a tree, if you have a pet, you know, if you have a chicken or whatever, they all grow to the maximum of their potential, right? But humans are the only ones that self-sabotage and cut themselves short. And, you know, what is it? Michelangelo had a quote. It's not that the greatest risk is not that people will set goals and fail to achieve them. It's that they set goals too low. Like, it's not, I'm paraphrasing here. Obviously, I don't have it off the top of my head, but it's like a Michelangelo quote. And it's like, the greatest risk is not that people will aim too high and fail to reach it. It's that they'll aim too low and hit it. And that's really the big thing here. We're here for growth. We're here for an experience. We're here to improve. I love that.
And that's a very, again, a very clever point you've raised, because different people have different potential. Mm. All of us. Doesn't matter who you are. And so there's two aspects of that. If the role doesn't change and they're doing a good job, that's fine. But if the role grows and the responsibilities grow, you've, as a manager, you've got to ensure that the people have the potential to grow into that role. And you've got to, first of all, you've got to find, do they have it? And then you've got to work with them to realize that potential. Yeah. And that's paving the way for somebody. And some people will continue to grow, and some people,
yep,
you know, will hit a plateau, and that's all they can do. And if you push them past that, they'll fail.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the Peter principle. That's
it is.
Promoted to their highest level of incompetence. You're a good sales rep, we make you the sales trainer. You're a good sales trainer, we make you a sales manager. You're a good sales manager, we make you, you know, director of sales. You're a good director of sales, we make you chief sales officer, and you suck at that, so we leave you there. And that's, yeah, you can't demote.
Yeah, that's the Peter principle. You get promoted beyond your capability.
Yes.
And it's bad for everybody. And
yeah.
And recognizing getting people to recognize that and holding the mirror up to them, because some people's ambition outweighs
their skill set. Yeah.
Their abilities or their potential.
Yeah.
And that's very difficult. And that's quite often why people will leave a company. But if you can, as I said before, if everyone understands what you're doing and where, and you create that team spirit, I think you bind everybody within the business together. It's interesting, in companies I ran, every 6 months I'd address all the staff and I'd tell them, hey, here's our objectives. This is where we stand. This is what we've achieved. We haven't done well here. We've done very well here, and we're going to change, or we're going to keep it going, or whatever it is. So everybody heard it from the boss and could understand.
Yeah, that's important.
What we were doing.
Now, you're doing a lot with AI now. How does AI change your view? I mean, again, you've seen so many different seasons and cycles and innovations, the .com boom, you know, the financial collapse 2008. How do you feel about AI? What do you, I mean, obviously, I know you're working with it, you're incorporating it, everybody sort of is, but what's your, I feel like, what's your unique view on that?
Well, it's the industrial revolution of our time, yeah, and it's here. We can't fight it because it's already here, and I think it's going to continue for quite a while to come. If you think the industrial revolution, some economists think it finished in the mid to later 1800s, others that it went into the 1900s, which is most probably true. And I think we're in for the same here. So we are pushing all our clients to view and to review where can we use AI in their business? And we've developed a program. We call it the AI Readiness Program, and it's a questionnaire they fill out, and it's AI generated too, but it shows you what the latest is, where we can incorporate it. And we say to our clients, it's not to get rid of people, yeah, because your people still have to do the work, coordinate with people, influence them, and so forth. But it improves your potential of productivity because if you've got, I don't know, so many people doing jobs and the routine or the research or whatever it is, you can cut that in half or three quarters, it gives them the ability to do more and the potential for you to grow your business.
Yes.
Yeah, without having to put on a lot more staff, till you soak up the capability of everybody
Yep.
is great. And in terms of productivity throughout the business, not just, a lot of people think productivity is only in a factory. That's not true at all. It's in every aspect of the business. And so, yes, we're raising it with everybody. Where and how can we best in? And so far, there's, in general terms, I'm talking very broadly, there's general acceptance. Yes, we have to do it. They agree. But in many cases, even though they've agreed, yes, we'll look at it and do it, there's passive resistance. And I think that's, and I say to my clients, you're going to wake up one morning and your competitors are going to be down the road from you and you can see them disappearing into the future. And it's going to be more difficult for you to catch up than
Yeah.
if you start paving the way now, because as with the Industrial Revolution, it grew, grew, and grew into different areas. Because everyone was looking to try and mechanize or automate some processes, and I think that's going to happen again. So, and it's going to change, and even the way we work, it's changing. Yeah. So, and if we don't adopt that change, and if it works, we should keep doing it, and if it doesn't, we've got to find a different way. But if we resist it, we'll pay the price to varying degrees.
I really agree with that. Greg Glassman, the founder of CrossFit, which was one of the fastest growing fitness brands in history, he gave this talk once. And again, I'm paraphrasing, but he would say that markets are ultimately unknown and unknowable. If I asked you how many people are in market to buy a car today, you could look at keyword searches and foot traffic, but ultimately the number is unknown and it's constantly in flux. Somebody thinks they want a car, decides not. And so it's unknown and unknowable, but everyone can acknowledge and recognize excellence. And so excellence should be the North Star, right? Problems are markets, not demographics. The problem you solve is what the businesses are built around, solving that problem for people. And so the focus needs to be on being excellent, providing a solution in any way, shape, or form. If it's outsourcing or offshoring, or if it's developing a new technology, or if it's adopting AI. It needs to be about providing a more excellent service for a lower price, ultimately, at the end of the day, right? More value. Was it cheap, good, and quick? Pick two out of three. You can't, it's tough to get all three. Most businesses only have one, but you try to give people two out of three. If you can get two out of three, you're doing okay.
Sorry, I thought you'd finish. Go on.
No, you're good. Go ahead.
So what I was going to say is, see, cheap is not always my criteria. To my mind, it's value for money. Yeah. So if you buy a luxury car, yeah, and you can afford it and it gives you that luxury, that's value for money for what you have. If you buy a cheaper car, yeah, it's got to be value for money. And in a product or a service, that's what it's got to be. It's got to represent value for money. And that's the criteria. Is it worth the price I'm paying? Yeah. And if you have a terrific bottle of wine and it costs you $40 or $210, is the $210 bottle of wine five times as good as the
It's funny you mentioned that because when I was 19, I worked my summers. I was living on my own in British Columbia. I moved out west when I moved out of home when I was 17. But I spent 2 summers working multiple jobs, and one of the day job would be in a winery. It was good pay, hourly pay. I'm outdoors all day and I'm thinning leaves and stuff. And a couple of the places I worked at, they would give you a free bottle of wine from the list with your paycheck. And so I would sample everything. And what I learned now is that, like you said, the most expensive bottle to me, it's not like when I buy wine for myself, I just typically grab the lower, I mean, to each their own, but I found that the taste difference and the drunkenness seemed to be pretty much the same. Whether it was a $400 bottle or a $5 bottle, I was like, tastes the same and I'm just as drunk. So, hey, alcohol content was the same. So that's a good insight into marketing. I look at that, like when I look at food labels and stuff now, how much of this is marketing and perceived value versus actual raw materials of what I'm buying?
And I think, you know, in a service, if you provide something worthwhile, you know, our criteria when we look at a job, is there a job there? Can we do it? Will it be worthwhile? Yeah. And will the returns we estimate for the fee we're going to charge be worthwhile? If you charge $100,000 and you get 150 and we improve by 150,000, that's not a good deal. But if we improve someone's business by $500,000 in increased profits or $1 million, yeah, and we charge, I don't know, 100 or 200,000, is that a good deal? Yes. That's value for money. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the people you've got working on it, the number of people and what they provide and the return you get, and you've got to be measured on that return.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's drinking a bottle and you enjoy it or you improve productivity in a company, they're the same. You know, you've got to see the value. And of course, in a business, it's measurable. Right. So, and the criteria that you set, you, along the way, you've got to see, yes, I'm achieving those returns and I'm giving value for money to my client.
Yeah, I love that.
Or the product you're selling.
We've kind of danced around this, but I'm just curious to really hit the nail on the head. What are some of the greatest mistakes that you see your clients and other entrepreneurs making?
Okay, there's a number of answers to this. I learned in my, I'm going to answer this in different ways. I learned in my career that when I had a management team, I tried to employ everyone in their roles that they were better at doing what they did than I did. Yeah. So the team I put together was a team of champions. Yeah. And so that's what I always aim for. And, you know, and those people underneath them, I wanted the best people as well. And so, you know, you've got good people. And it's not only good at what they do, but conceptually, they've got to be able to see where the business is going. They've got to be able to criticize other people, and that criticism has to be accepted. And there's got to be a willingness, if someone says something smarter than you, that you change immediately. And you let go of what, you know, someone, if someone says to me in the morning, hey, Vic, I think we should do this. And I think, hey, that's smarter than me. Whatever I've thought up to that point, see you later. Yeah, it's got to be. And I think so many business owners, because they've started a business, the business has grown, they've made money, and they've got a nice house, they've got a nice boat, their children go to private schools, they go overseas every 2 years. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a client, had a $30 million business and was making 5% and was taking salary of $250,000 and made 5% operating income. Yeah. But in the Western world, the average income of private business is 8%. So that was our standard. Yeah. And that's, you know, 60% better. Mm-hmm. So by the time we finished, we'd increased the turnover fourfold and we'd gone from 5% to 12.8% operating income. Right. And you know, he was open to change. He was ready to listen. And we, when we spoke, we got support. And he, you know, we know what we know. He knows what he knows. But it worked terrifically as a team. Whereas other people, you know, as I said, they've got they've earned good money, but not great money. And they think they've been touched by.
Yeah. Nothing fails like success. You have a taste of success, or what you think is success, and then you feel like you got the golden touch. I know.
Correct, and it's relative, right? And many years ago, one of my mentors, he actually said what I just said to you. He said, if someone says something to you, accept it immediately and let it go. And if it works well, keep doing it. If it doesn't, change. And he also said to me, he said, Vic, the biggest idiot can say the most brilliant thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think that's...
Yeah, wisdom is being able to discern between the two. I found in my earlier career, and maybe still now, I'm a very assertive type person, but I felt like in my younger years, I'm 43 at the time of this recording, maybe my mid, late 20s, I felt like I could be abrasive and overly assertive. So I actually started, I heard this somewhere, I don't remember where I heard it, but I actually started writing on a piece of paper I keep in my pocket, because I keep my hands in my pocket sometimes in meetings. And it said, what if they're right? And so when I would be at a meeting with someone, they would say something that I thought was incorrect, I would feel the paper and I go, well, what if they're right? And it just changed my approach, where I could still disagree, but I was open to the idea that what if they're right? Because everyone's so sure of things. I mean, every team's confident that they're going to win the game. You know, like Mike Tyson's, everyone's got a plan until they get punched in the face, right? So everyone's so certain until something happens. So I love that. Vic, this has been a great call. I've got a couple pages of notes. If someone's ready for change and willing to listen, if they want to reach out, talk to you and learn more, what are some of the best ways for them to get in touch?
They can call me or email me, and we can have a chat. As I said a few moments ago, to decide, is there a job and can we do it and will it be worthwhile?
So that contact info, let me pull this up. Let me see if I got your email here. What's your email address?
Vic@collaborates, collaborates.com.au.
Vic@collaborates.com.au.
Correct.
I love that. That's actually pretty easy to remember. So if you guys have some questions, go send them an email. Vic@collaborates. Is it plural?
Yeah.
Yeah. Collaborates. Yeah. C-O-L-L-A-B-O-R-A-T-E-S.
C-O-L-L-A-B-O-R-A-T-E-S. Well, there's an S on the end.
Yes. Vic@collaborates.com.au. You can also check out vicdorsen.com.au, vicdorsen.com.au. You can look him up on LinkedIn as well if you have any questions. Vic, thank you so much for coming and sharing your wisdom and knowledge with us. It's always an honor and a pleasure when we connect. I really appreciate knowing you have your own direct reports, your own community. You were at a networking thing today. I'm sure you got people to follow up with. Thank you for coming and sharing with my audience tonight so we can all do better.
Daryl, I've enjoyed every minute. Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.